Let me introduce our final speaker today, Professor James Spillane. He's on the faculty at Northwestern University School of Education and Social Policy and the Institute for Policy Research. He's a senior researcher with the Consortium for Policy Research, and he has over 15 peer-reviewed articles. And he's so young. Wonderful. His work focuses on studying the intersection of instructional policy and teacher and administrator practice, as well as state and local government relations in education. He teaches classes at Northwestern for undergraduate and graduate students. And he told me that last week he was teaching at a National Association of School Administrators. So I heard him speak last fall in Washington, and I feel confident that you'll enjoy his talk in improving teacher practice as much as I did. So Dr. Spillane's topic today is improving teacher practice. Can policy and peer mentoring help teachers do better?
One other little piece about myself, which is important given the research I do, I come to the field of policy and education policy and study of policy from the classroom. I spent a number of years as a teacher in, if you haven't detected the accent, in inner city school in Ireland, Cork City. You more than likely all heard the uproar last week when Thames released the performance of American students on the third International Mathematics and Science study, and we came 19 out of 21 nations. Our students were almost at the bottom. The president, the Republican respondent to the president last week, were very upset. Although they had different ideas, they both agreed that we had a problem. As far as I'm concerned, to improve kids' performance in mathematics and science, there will have to be a lot of changes across the school system, district level, school level, parent involvement. But unless what teachers and students do in their math and science classroom changes fundamentally, there will be no improvement. Unless the problems that kids work on and how they work on them, unless the expectations that teachers have for kids change, we won't see an improvement. The main point of my talk today is that I want to suggest to you that one of the ways of realizing that sort of change, it'll be very difficult, is by changing the enactment zones that most teachers have when it comes to responding to state, federal, or local government policies. And very simply, I'll go into it in a little while. What I mean by enactment zones is the area where the ideals of reformers, be they national standards or state standards, where the ideals of reformers meet the world of practice and practitioners. And for most teachers, and we've known this for a long time, for most teachers, that is the individual classroom on their own, practicing in solo. I'm not saying, most teachers do go to conferences. Most teachers do pick up journals. But where they garner or grasp the ideas of reform is on their own. And I suggest, based on the study I'm going to talk to you this morning about, that until we change that, it's unlikely we can bring about the fundamental changes that seem necessary. The study was supported by the National Science Foundation. It was 5 years. It was involved both quantitative but mostly qualitative methods. A study of the state policy system around mathematics and science in Michigan and the local government policy system involving 9 school districts geographically diverse, ranging from our Upper Peninsula to both the east and west sides of the Lower Peninsula. Survey of teachers, we undertook a survey of teachers, all third, fourth grade teachers, and all 7th and 8th grade mathematics and science teachers in the 9 districts. And based on that survey, based on the items that had to do with their reported practice, we picked a subsample of 25 teachers to observe and interview. the subsample was a purposeful sample. In other words, we picked them because they were teachers that were most likely, given their response to the survey, to be doing the reforms. In other words, we were interested in people who were trying to radically improve their mathematics and science instruction and claim to have been have had some success in that direction. We felt that by looking at those teachers, we could learn something about what it might take. Okay, with that background. There's a lot of talk about improving mathematics and science. You'll have to help because, you know, this stuff is complicated. We get a lot about teaching for understanding, higher standards, more challenging standards. It's not always clear what people mean. I mean, I bet you there is no teacher in this state who doesn't teach for understanding. Everybody teaches for understanding. So it's really, what do we mean by these new standards? You have 30 seconds. Seriously take a look at the problem and calculate for me the answer. I won't ask you, but it'll help if you calculate the answer. Just take the first problem. Calculate the answer, write it down, and then I'm going to continue and talk about... I want to use these examples to just try and create a richer sense of what we mean by more demanding, more challenging mathematics standards. The first problem is taken from a little piece that Alan Schoenfeld at Berkeley recently wrote. 70% of kids on the NAEP test can get the computation right. 31, remainder 2. No problem. Only 30% get the right answer. The number of buses that it would take. Kids understand how to do the computations. Most of them get it. They're pretty good at it. But they work like almost like calculators or computers. We program them, plug in the numbers. For example, these two, the computation of these two problems are identical, but they have two different answers. In a classroom I was in recently, most kids in the classroom got the same answer for both problems. It's almost like all the mathematics is about is having the procedure down, getting the answer, 8 remainder 3, move on. Even though with 8 remainder 3, we would have a load of senior citizens left at the hotel. So basically how I understand the mathematics reforms, this push for understanding, is not that we're throwing computation out the window, but that we want kids to understand what it is they're trying to do when they're computing, and be able to apply that knowledge in some meaningful situation. Just to point out this one to you, when asked to do this problem, which is 335 added 5 times and divided by 5, most kids go through the entire procedure, when in fact it's straightforward, if you just thought about it. In the 25 classrooms we visited, we were interested in the extent to which teachers were promoting the mathematics standards. Were they pressing kids to get at something other than basic computation? Were they getting kids to understand the mathematics? The way I keep this in my head for myself is a distinction I draw between procedural mathematics and principled mathematics. Procedural are the computation, the long division. That's important. And nobody is saying throw it out. Principled is understanding the ideas that undergird the sort of problem that we have up here. Understanding that the notion of remainder in division varies depending on the particular problem you have. Sometimes you can throw out the remainder, but when it's 3 senior citizens, you cannot. That's important. Let me take you to our first two teachers. What became extremely surprising for us is that when we looked in these 25 teachers' classrooms, we found that only four teachers had fundamentally revised the tasks they had kids work on, that's the exercises or questions, and the way they played those out. And by that I mean only four teachers were presenting tasks and enacting them in ways that got beyond the procedural mathematics. Here are two teachers. Both of these teachers are not resisting the reforms. Both are firmly convinced they're doing problem solving as promoted by state policymakers in Michigan and by NCTF. These are just two quotes from them. Here are two of the problems that... can you see the bottom problem? At the very end? At Tufts Diner? Here are two problems. Yes, these teachers are doing problem solving, and they reported to us that they do these sorts of problems regularly. In fact, this problem has more complex mathematics in it than the first one. But the interesting thing about these problems is that if you look at this, explain, use pictures to make your argument clear. That sets up a very different dynamic than stand up when you know the answer. The tasks are important because one teacher is saying to kids, I just want the answer. And in fact, the whole lesson was around long division. The other teacher was saying very clearly, yes, an answer is important, but you better be sure you can tell me why and explain it to me. I just don't want to have you being able to play out the procedure. As I said, it's important to remember, these teachers are not resisting. Both of them are firmly convinced they're doing the reforms. We found four of these teachers in our 25 sample, despite the fact that everyone told us they were doing the reforms. We found 11 of these teachers. And we found 10 teachers that were somewhere in between. They had these sorts of tasks, but when they played them out in their practice, the principal knowledge got completely lost. They didn't know how to ask the questions to push kids' thinking. Okay. You might well say, well, what's going on? Well, one thing, first of all, let's be very clear about is that all teachers were attending to the state standards. All teachers were taking the state MEEP assessment very carefully, which was pressing problem solving. And they were doing, these are just some quotes from the teachers, a sample of, you see the importance that they gave to the state assessments. And most teachers were attending to something about procedural knowledge. The issue here is that state levers, state accountability, state incentives, though important in and of themselves, cannot get teachers to go to the substance, the key ideas that they have to get to if they want to practice in ways that seem essential if we want to reform mathematics. Teacher learning, without teacher learning, we are not going to see the sorts of changes that I think are essential. And bigger sticks, I don't care who's holding them up, whether it's state legislators or district legislators, bigger sticks, juicier carrots dangled in front of teachers, they do have a role, but in and of themselves, they won't get teachers to learn. It's like sometimes we have the idea in classrooms, if we shout louder at the kids, they'll get it. Uh-uh, it doesn't work. I've tried it. When I looked at the four teachers who had changed and compared them to the 11 who had not, the key difference that began to emerge had to do with what I call teachers' enactment zones. That is, it had to do with the four teachers who had made these tremendous changes had social and public enactment zones. They engaged in ongoing conversations with colleagues about mathematics. The other 11 teachers were very private, very individualistic. Close the classroom door. I do my thing. Hands off. Very quickly, for these public social enactment zones, there are three important dimensions.
First of all, there's social capital. Basically, the idea is that the relations among people, they trust one another, they collaborate, they talk. And that enables them to do things that they could not do on their own. There's human capital. You can talk to a lot of people, but if some person in the group or in the school or in the district doesn't understand the mathematics, it doesn't matter. Because you can't really press on the sort of understanding that's necessary. In other words, you need some expertise. At times, this expertise came from a local teacher, or at other times, it came from external university person, external mathematics and science center, and the material resources supported learning. In other words, the curriculum that these four teachers used was not just for kids. It was also an opportunity for them to learn. Basically, enactment zones, the social enactment zones, the ones that went beyond the classroom, were important for three reasons. Teachers began to see the reforms. And I stress the word see. Because the two teachers I showed you earlier, for the second teacher who did the Tufts Diner problem, that was all a problem of seeing. She did not see that what she was doing on the problem solving was not changing the sort of mathematics she was giving her kids. So by talking with one another, by arguing and deliberating about the ideas, they began to see the inadequacies of earlier understandings. All of this is some of the data that we collected. They began to learn the practical knowledge involved in doing the reforms. Very often there's the idea, if we figure out what reformers are telling us, then we're there. But the enactment, the challenges that come up when you try and teach in these ways in classrooms are difficult. And they have to be learned. And they're easier learned when you have other teachers who can talk with you about them. And most importantly, they became powerful incentives for change. Colleagues, talking with colleagues about revising mathematics, these teachers began to realize that there's peer pressure here. I better do this. I put a question mark after implications because I guess the way I think about these is if I was given the task of thinking about policy that would support teacher learning, what kind of guiding principles, not necessarily implications, what kind of principles or ideas would I have at the back of my mind? And I basically would have four. First of all, teacher learning is essential. And even though teacher preparation needs to be revised, that will not leave us off the hook. Ongoing learning is essential. It's essential in most careers. There's no reason why it shouldn't be essential in teaching. I've made this point pretty clear. External incentives and accountability mechanisms on their own are unlikely to be sufficient. Important, insufficient on their own. Policies and programs that target groups are more likely to be successful. If you target the individual, there's a potential that you might undermine any effort at collaboration. If you target a group, there's a reason to come together. Policies designed to restructure need to be developed in tandem with policies designed to support teacher learning. We have a real habit of, schools need to restructure. They need new organizational structures. So we have site-based management, et cetera, et cetera. That's all done over here. Then over here, we have policies that teacher learning, professional development. These two issues are closely related. It's restructuring, surely, so that teachers can learn, so in order to teach better, so that we can improve kids' scores.
Questions for Dr. Spillane? Yes.
Some of the international comparison tests are showing that fourth graders do much better in comparison in America. In an eighth grade, it falls off. In a tenth grade, the bottom basically drops out. Are the fourth grade teachers teaching more of the principal ideas behind mathematics and science than the eighth grade teachers and the tenth grade teachers, or is there another reason for this bottom line?
Right.
I'm not sure, but it's a question that could be, given the Thames database, which is now public, it's a question you could investigate to see if the topic coverage... I mean, the beauty of Thames is that it allows us to see what exactly... I have problems with some other parts of it, but it allows us to see what kids are taught when in school and to compare that across classrooms and across countries. So you could really test out the question to see if the principle, if at the earlier grades you're getting more principled mathematical knowledge. I doubt it. I'd be surprised. I think this is a problem across the board in the mathematics curriculum.
If you were going to try to move from this higher level of math reasoning, can you use existing teachers, or would you need to train new stock, or can you improve teachers who are already practicing?
I think we can improve a large percentage of those that are already practicing. I think Linda Darling-Hammond has thrown around the figure that something like 25% she thinks are we can't do anything with, and it's a waste of time. I'm not sure where she brings that figure from. But if she's roughly right, there is 75% that we can work with. The trouble is that working with usually involves taking them to the university for a course on their own. The trouble is that it's a one-off workshop, or a week-long workshop in the summer, again on their own. And I think the way to think about it would be to see what in elementary grades are the essential ideas, the essential principled ideas that go into the mathematics curriculum. Like the notion of place value is very important because it undergirds a lot of the things we do. I'm not a mathematics person, by the way. I've learned all this in the last 3 or 4 years because I learned the procedural stuff. But if we could package that in a way like the summer mat program at Mount Holyoke does, where you bring teachers in, you teach them about the mathematical ideas at the same time as you get them to think about teaching the mathematics, I think we could make huge progress. The other thing is, we should think about, we develop curricula entirely as never thinking about how that curriculum might teach teachers. It's all about what kids should be learning.
Okay, this question back here. The question is about the difference between quantitative and qualitative research. Why was this a qualitative study rather than a quantitative study? Might it have reached the same conclusions as a quantitative study? Is that fair?
Yeah, first of all, I don't think it's the environment that determines the methodology you use. It's the question you have, and a lot of the questions are not amenable to quantitative methods. Now, let me address this study first. We did use the Thames questionnaire, quantitative survey, and based on that, which actually got at indicated things like people's disposition to the reform, their reports on practice. We know from previous work that teachers' reports are practice, are notoriously unreliable indicators of what goes on in practice. Thus, given that what was most important to me was I wanted to feel secure about what we were claiming here, observations were key. So the question that you have is what drives whether you use quantitative and qualitative. I can't answer your question about the quantitative-qualitative because a lot of the work that I know in that does work on looking at the school as an organization would draw conclusions, and this is quantitative work based on teachers' response to surveys in large samples of schools, would draw conclusions that would not disagree with my conclusion about policy enactment in this case. But maybe there are other fields that I'm not familiar with within education where there is disagreement all the time. I tend to see a lot more agreement between quantitative and qualitative work, and I tend to see them as supporting one another rather than as opposite ends of some continuum. Certainly, I think without good qualitative work and good quantitative work, we won't get to a better understanding of the issues. And I'm not sure if I've addressed fully your question.